The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Web Studio, Primetime Advertising Corporation, and the Law Office of Thomas Pinkerton. The views and opinions are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you find Christians to be so foolish. Take Brit Hume on Fox News, daring to talk about Jesus on a news program of all places. Yes, Fox News made news this week. We'll be discussing this provocative story. I'll also continue answering some good, interesting questions from atheists and other Bible skeptics. I hope you're enjoying your winter so far. You know, between a record cold winter all over the world and smoking gun email spotlighting fraudulent information by scientists who attempted to prove the phenomenon of global warming, many who still think it's a good idea to tax our brains out for the sake of a greener land are retreating from all the hot talk and offering in exchange the brilliant phrase, climate change. Yeah, climate change. Good one. Now, I don't mean to be sarcastic with the word brilliant here, because truthfully, for those who wish to win an argument apart from facts, the new chosen term is quite clever. Why? Because with this new description of our planetary condition, they will absolutely, positively be right. One thing we can say with certainty about the climate, it's always changing. The next time we're concerned about the destruction of the Earth, perhaps a journey to the North Pole would be in order. Not to study the polar ice caps, but rather to ask the man himself. Santa Claus, just ask Santa Claus if there's global warming. Now, I realize Santa is only a figment of mythology, but evidently, so was all the talk about global warming. Meanwhile, some people think Jesus belongs in mythology. They are mistaken, sincerely mistaken, but mistaken nevertheless. Senior Fox News analyst Brit Hume is receiving a lot of flack for encouraging Tiger Woods to become a Christian. You will recall an earlier show where I said that the life of Tiger Woods is none of our business simply because the man is a celebrity. Now, I still stand by those remarks, but today I'm not talking about Woods, I'm talking about Hume. Whether or not Brit Hume should be giving advice to poor Tiger is not the area of contention. That's not what Brit Hume is getting in trouble over. After all kinds of fellow journalists who rebuke Brit Hume openly, such as Keith Olbermann of MSNBC, have certainly been willing to throw their own two cents in the direction of the golfer's latest sand trap. The problem, according to Olbermann and others, seems to be that a journalist would dare offer an opinion, especially an opinion about religion. Are we really supposed to believe that Keith Olbermann doesn't understand the difference between a news anchorman and a news commentator? Is Keith himself shy about his own opinion when he pillages George Bush, Sarah Palin, Fox News, or any other conservative entity night after night after night? Give me a break here. As for bringing up religion, excuse me, but a television commentator is allowed to comment on anything he likes. How many liberal commentators keep reminding us of what a peaceful religion Islam is, despite all the terrorism? That is supposed to be perfectly fine. But say something positive about Christianity and people scream for a phone to dial 911. Oh, wait. I almost forgot. It is okay to discuss Christianity on television so long as the pundit tells us that Jesus would have approved illegal immigration and that the Bible supports gay marriage because God is a God of love. What? Some of you who actually read the Bible claim that such a scriptural correlation is taken out of context? Well, I agree with you, but keep it under your hat, will you? Keep it to yourself. If you say it on television, it will be inappropriate. Speaking of television, I was on KUSI News last Monday morning, but there's a fun little story that goes behind the experience, and that experience has to do with laryngitis. Now, given the choice between being sick with all the accompanying discomfort, the choice of being sick or losing my voice, I would choose the painful sickness hands down. Because of all the public speaking I do, not to mention a radio show and weekly Bible studies, losing my voice is not very convenient. Also, just to be honest here and show you my motives aren't super spiritual, I don't even enjoy casually hanging out with people if our time together doesn't include loud-mouthed fun. As it happens, I did get laryngitis a couple of days before Christmas. However, precisely because of the holidays and my desire to take some time off, visit my kids and all that other stuff, I canceled my classes. I arranged for a repeat broadcast on the radio. I should also say that unlike other times, my voice had not gone away completely. Yes, it sounded hoarse and raspy, not good enough for public speaking, but certainly adequate to chat over a meal or a board game with family and friends. I remember saying to myself, this is one of those rare times when my voice does not matter. No radio show, no Sunday school, no Bible study, doesn't matter. The next morning, I receive an email from one of KUSI News' producers about an article written for San Diego Rostra regarding Sarah Palin. They asked if I could come in as soon as possible and do a live television interview on Good Morning San Diego. Now, fortunately, they were willing to postpone until January 4th. God came through as always, but not without first reminding me that he has a sense of humor. For those of you who missed it, here is the audio of my interview last Sunday morning on KUSI. Now, I should say we got this off of the internet, and our recording is not a great recording, even though my voice was finally fine when I did it. This recording sounds a little craggly. It did not sound that way over television. But anyway, here's my interview on Good Morning San Diego.
You know, the new movie Blindside is scoring big at the box office. It stars Sandra Bullock, who plays a conservative, spunky, and compassionate woman all in one. Radio talk show host Bob Siegel believes Sandra Bullock has the same striking similarities as Sarah Palin. Yet Palin isn't quite so popular and not getting the great reviews. He joins us now to talk more about an article that is making the rounds. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
The name of your article, A Woman by Any Other Name Might Just Be Respected. You wrote this at the end of December, and it's been picked up by all kinds of newspapers.
Yeah, it's been an interesting response because one of my bylines when I write and on the radio, I always say, this is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious. And I'm watching this movie, which was phenomenal. I've never been a big Sandra Bullock fan, I should say. I think she's an okay actress. I haven't thought she was in great movies. But she just did a phenomenal job. And, of course, she's playing a role in a true story. And I'm noticing that, you know, she's up for a Golden Globe Award. That's mm-hmm. a Hollywood Foreign Press. That's not a conservative organization by any way, shape, or form. It's doing great at the box office. People from both sides of the aisle like her, left to right.
And the character that she plays is a conservative.
She's a conservative. She's a Republican. She's a Christian. She's a member of the NRA. She's spunky. She's feisty. She's blunt when she talks. She's cute. She reaches out to the disenfranchised.
Attractive.
I just described Sarah Palin. And now, not that she's a politician or that she has Sarah Palin's policies, but what's interesting is when you hear Sarah Palin critique, they never talk about her policies. They talk about all those things. Oh, member of the NRA, and she's a woman, and she's spunky and blunt. And so it's really interesting, the very unfair way she's been treated. I wrote a blog right before she even spoke at the Republican convention, and I just said, they're coming after her. Nobody even knows who she is. They knew her in Alaska. She was mm-hmm. huge. I said, they're coming after her. They're going to dig up stuff on her. They didn't really find anything. They practically had to make stuff up, like, was it really her baby? Was it her daughter's? It's just amazing how this woman has been pillaged. And I think people are responding to the name Sarah Palin, and it's giving them a reaction because they're basing it on what they hear around the water cooler and what sounds politically correct, and they don't really know the woman herself.
Well, what do you think is at play here? Is it sexism? Is it because some people think she's a knucklehead, that she's not what they thought she was? What is at play?
She's no knucklehead. Anyone who thinks she's a knucklehead, she'll have the last laugh. I think the idea that the Republicans, the conservatives, had such an independent woman nominated to be vice president, the idea is, oh, no, we can't have
women's lib on the... But even the conservatives initially, they weren't... John McCain, he didn't really defend her very well during the campaign.
Well, I have seen him defend her, but some of the members of his own campaign really threw under the bus. You're absolutely right about that. You know, the whole thing with this Katie Couric interview was part of the problem.
Where she came, where Sarah Palin did come across as uninformed and unprepared for that interview.
She did come across that way, but, you know, they taped that thing for days. There were just hours and hours. And, of course, Katie Couric picked that 1 minute. And, you know, Katie's up there going, not to belabor the point, but let me belabor it again. She was trying to nail her, and probably they could have done a better job of letting Sarah be herself. Here's the mythology, the historical revision that's already going on. They're saying Sarah Palin lost the election for John McCain. Listen, McCain and Sarah Palin were leading Obama by double digits, and then we had the economic tsunami, and they weren't able to recover from that. McCain was doing horrible until he brought Sarah Palin in. It was like a bolt of lightning. She energized his campaign. There were Republicans that weren't going to vote for McCain until she came upon. What happened was the economic thing. Also, they wouldn't let her be herself. She wanted to challenge Obama about his background, about Bill Ayers, his terrorist friend, and McCain didn't do it. Now, this one I can't prove, Sandra. I'll never be able to prove this, but I suspect somebody sat down with John McCain one day and said, do you want to go down in history as the first person to defeat a leading African-American candidate? And McCain said, oh, gee, you know, I'm known as John McCain who reaches across the aisle. He would not let Sarah be herself. He wouldn't really fight Obama because he was too worried about what the New York Times was going to say about it.
Well, there's a lot to talk about. A lot of people still talking about this. And you can hear you have a radio show that's on the weekends on KCBQ.
KCBQ, 3 o'clock on Sundays live, and it's rebroadcast Saturday evenings as well. And I'll be also hosting, I substitute host for Rick Amato a lot, so 9 o'clock to 11 o'clock tonight on KCBQ, you can hear me host the Rick Amato show.
Interesting stuff. Bob Siegel, thanks for stopping by.
Such a pleasure to meet
you. Nice to meet you as well.
To build your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com.
Call Bob now at 888-344-1170. That's toll free, 888-344-1170. Bob may have strong opinions, but he also likes to hear what you have to say.
Welcome back to Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. Some people believe Intelligent Talk cannot possibly include a discussion of God. A couple of weeks ago, I began to read some questions from a fellow named Thomas, a very open, cordial fellow writing us all the way from Ireland. We just barely got started on it before the show ran out of time, so I'm going to restart it again. Thomas was responding to an article I wrote entitled, Can the Existence of God Be Proven? heavy as the question sounds, it was actually an extremely brief article, and you will understand Thomas's challenges better and the context of our discussion better if I take a couple of minutes to first read the article. Here goes from a blog on bobsiegel.townhall.com, where you can go to read that and many articles I've written about Christianity, bobsiegel.townhall.com. Can the existence of God be proven? And I say this, in my book, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, I make the point that God's existence cannot be proven or disproved. Instead of claiming to prove the existence of God, Christians and other theists should offer evidence. I define evidence as that which points to a high probability that a given claim is true. I define proof as something we can observe with our own senses. In science, nothing is proven unless it is repeatable. Since none of us were there when the universe came into existence, we cannot prove or disprove God. There is, however, another definition of proof, that of an observable working equation. Let me say this as carefully as I can. If we want to use this mathematical definition, then there is proof for the existence of God. At the moment, we are not talking about the God of the Bible. That's a whole different subject, and we would have to study historical evidence for those kinds of conclusions. But the proof for some type of deity? Sure, absolutely. In fact, it's really quite simple. Something had to always exist. You can't get something out of nothing. This something had to be a personality, not a human necessarily, but some kind of thinking, feeling, sentient being. Why do I say that? Because otherwise there is no explanation for the origin of personality. This is the fundamental hurdle in the field of artificial intelligence. Can a computer ever become self-aware? Is it possible to recreate the brain with its ability to think? Can sentience be produced in the laboratory? Only time will answer these questions, but meanwhile, they beg the much bigger question. Since stars and rocks and dust cannot think, and since chemicals outside the chemicals of the brain cannot think, where did personality come from? Do we get the personal from the personal, or do we get the personal from the impersonal? Now we can add it up like an equation. 0 + 0 = 0. The alternative equation goes like so. If something had to always exist, if you can't get something out of nothing, and if the personal must come from the personal, then this something which always existed is some kind of eternal personality. We have offered a proof for the existence of God. Well, of course, our friend Thomas in Ireland takes issue with this. Now, the way I'm going to read this dialogue that he and I had over the internet that I'm going to share with you, what happens is he's quoting from my article bit by bit. So you're going to hear bits of my article again, then you're going to hear Thomas's response, and then you're going to hear my response to Thomas. Then we go back again, another bit of the article. The reason I read you the whole article first is that you'd understand the context and understand where we're going. Otherwise, it would be too disjointed. So Thomas starts quoting, I won't read that part again, but he quotes my definition. And then he says, I agree. Proof is a mathematical and logical construct and has no real-world inference. Unfortunately, the use of the word has entered the lexicon and is widely used, so much so that when I use it, I always present my understanding of its meaning. I define proof as a logical conclusion arrived at when undeniable, demonstrable, justifiable evidence for a claim is presented, to such validity that all possible claims to the contrary are rendered void. Okay, now here is my response to Thomas. Thomas, according to that definition, I define proof differently in a manner similar to yours, and I contrast it with the word evidence. That is what I said in the excerpt from my book, which you quote anyway. And so we seem to agree that there are two definitions of proof, the mathematical one and the empirical one. They're similar because they both show us something we can observe, one mathematically and philosophically, the other more empirical. Okay, so then Thomas quotes me again. He quotes me saying, I define evidence as that which points to a high probability that a given claim is true. I define proof as something we can observe for our senses. And this, of course, is the other definition of proof. So he says, I agree with your definition of evidence, but I have a problem with the definition of proof. To say we can observe proof with our senses is to give proof a physical presence. This is incorrect. We can observe the evidence with our senses, but the proof is the mental application of logic to the consequences of physical evidence in order to arrive at a conclusion which either supports or refutes the claim. Well, Thomas, let me respond to that. Now, people attach different definitions to words, as you already admitted. As long as you understand what I mean when I say evidence and proof, then we can have a basis for discussion. I would say that the logic you want to add is there for the existence of God. Then Thomas quotes me again. He quotes me saying, in science, nothing is proven unless it is repeatable. And Thomas responds, to me, this sentence seems out of place here, but I'll take a shot at it anyway. Yes, repeatability does play a fundamental role in establishing a scientific proof, but it is not the event that a particular scientific theory proves that is required to be repeated. It is the experimental or theoretical evidence which supports the theory that requires repeatability. Namely, anybody can observe the evidence, apply the theory, and arrive at the same conclusion. Well, Thomas, depending on what kind of experiment we are talking about, I may or may not agree with you. Thomas quotes me again, saying, since none of us were there when the universe came into existence, we cannot prove or disprove God. And Thomas says, what? I cannot see how your claim in any way supports your conclusion. My understanding of what you are saying is that there are no direct witnesses when the universe came into existence, then there is no way of proving the cause of its emergence. Why you state God here confuses me, as it implied that there is a link between the emergence of the universe and God which cannot be established. Why God? Why not any other deity from the numerous creation account in other religions? Well, Thomas, I answered that in my article, which you read, which you quoted from. We cannot get the personal from the impersonal. That does not automatically confirm the God of the Bible, but some kind of thinking, feeling, being. After we study the testimony of history and archaeology, we begin to make a case for the God of the Bible. Thomas continues. He says, we also do not need a direct witness to an event in order to prove some aspect for it. Well, that's interesting. First, he's saying you can't prove God because there were no witnesses. Now he's saying we don't need witnesses. Anyway, he continues. For example, many murders happen without any witnesses, and yet more often than not, the murderer is convicted. This is done by obtaining evidence. Yes, that's true, Thomas, but according to the way you and I both defined proof and evidence, you are agreeing with me that technically that is not proof. That is only evidence and testimony. Evidence and testimony is significant. It's not proof. Unless somebody on the jury observed the murder, it's never proven to them. There's always a chance that the person was framed or something. Thomas says, even though I disagree with the route taken, I will agree with the conclusion. Thank you, Thomas. He then quotes me again. He says, there is, however, another definition of proof, that of an observable working equation. Let me say this as carefully as I can. If we want to use the mathematical definition, then there is a proof for the existence of God. Thomas says, there is a flaw in saying, if we use this, then we can prove that, as it defines a premise in order to obtain a desired conclusion. For example, if we say purple is gray, then we can prove that the elephant over there is purple. Well, yes, Thomas, but this is semantics now, because the definition of proof was agreed on, or at least we came close to agreeing it, both of us, so we're not talking about elephants. And then he quotes me again. When I say, at the moment, we are not talking about the God of the Bible, that's a whole different subject, and we would have to study historical evidence for those kinds of conclusions, but the proof for some type of deity, and now Thomas says, okay, we now need to redefine what you mean and meant up to this point by God. So what you are attempting to prove is the existence of a nondescript deity, not Bible God. It must be noted that if your proof is successful, it will only prove the existence of a deity and not the existence of any particular God. Isn't it interesting how Thomas is going out of his way to point that out when I already said that in my article? You heard it. He read it. I know he read the whole article. He would have read that whole article before he would have chosen to respond to it. It's so interesting. Even when you talk with an atheist and debate with an atheist, you're just talking about God generically. You're saying, we're not talking about the God of the Bible. We would have to kick in history and archaeology and spirituality to get to the God of the Bible, but let's just see if there's evidence for some kind of deity. They always assume at that point that we're already leaping to the God of the Bible. He was the one that leaped to it. Now he finally notices that I'm not necessarily saying this proves the God of the Bible. And then he points to me, oh, well, then you're not going to prove the God of the Bible, which I already said, but that's okay. Thomas is still a nice guy, and I'll continue reading these questions from Thomas about my article, Can We Prove the Existence of God?
This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480-539, W&S Electric.
Welcome back. This is Bob Segal. I'm reading to you some questions that Thomas wrote to us all the way from Ireland, challenging an article where I said that there's two kinds of proofs. There's the kind of proof that's empirical, where we observe events happening, and then there's what's called the mathematical equation that's called a proof. I said that the first kind, there's evidence for God. The only way to, of course, to prove that God exists is to meet God and have a relationship with the Holy Spirit, which the Bible says you can do, by the way. But we're not there when we're in the realm of philosophy and mathematics. But the mathematical definition says, can we look at an equation? Is this philosophically consistent? It asks those kinds of questions. Now, I admitted right at the top of my article that this was not going to give a proof for the existence of the God of the Bible. I believe in the God of the Bible. But once we've established that some kind of God exists, then we ask questions like, well, what kind of God is he? Was there a testimony? Was there a revelation from him throughout history? Then we look at the Bible. We look at its historical accuracy, the archaeology that supports it, fulfilled prophecies, ultimately the Holy Spirit bearing witness. There's all kinds of things that can kick in. So I want to make that clear. Eventually, with other apologetics and other questions and answers, I would get to the God of the Bible. But in this brief little article, I wasn't even claiming that it was going to prove the God of the Bible, just some kind of sentient, eternal personality. And Thomas at first didn't notice that I was doing that, and then he finally did, and he went out of his way to remind me. And so he says here again, it must be noted that if your proof is successful, it will only prove the existence of a deity and not the existence of any particular God. Well, that's true, Thomas. And again, as you acknowledge, my article never claimed that this argument alone proved the biblical God, just some kind of God. But now Thomas seeks to discredit my argument for some kind of God based on personality. He says, can I discredit it? Sure, absolutely. In fact, it's really quite simple. Let's go. Then he quotes me again. He quotes me saying something had to always exist. And Thomas says, why? What evidence do you have to support this claim? That this is really important, folks. He's asking me what evidence I have to support the claim that something had to always exist. Thomas, my evidence is that something coming from nothing is an absurdity. I don't mean this with any disrespect because I know you're an open guy, but it's an absurdity and it contradicts the very laws of logic and reason, which both of us seem to like. Thomas then says, why does something need to have always existed? The claim that something has existed for an infinite amount of time is no more plausible than the claim that something emerged from nothing. Well, that's not really true. Actually, the Bible talks about God existing outside of time and space. And again, we're not talking about the Bible yet, but quantum physics, apart from the Bible, is theorizing that time is not the immutable thing we thought it would. Within time and space, everything would have to have a beginning. Outside of time and space, a being could exist eternally. So that's not really implausible at all. But since we exist inside of time and space, to postulate that inside of time and space, something could have emerged from nothing? Really? How exactly could something have come from nothing? Now, Thomas, since you brought up repeatability and experimentation, let me ask you, is there any observation, any experiment of something coming from absolutely nothing? Then Thomas quotes me again. He says, you can't get something out of nothing. And then he says again, what evidence do you have to support this claim? In our current state of the universe, I will accept this claim. But at the time the universe emerged, the laws of physics were unknown. Well, that's interesting, Thomas. Laws of physics. Interesting phrase, laws of physics. Interesting. How do laws come into existence by randomness and chance? How do you have a law without a lawgiver? And then Thomas says, this is a time before the Planck time at which the laws of quantum theory break down. Scientists do know that the behavior of reality at points close to the Planck time is very strange indeed, and what we perceive as nothing may be very different. Well, it may be different, Thomas, but it would not be absolutely nothing. Thomas quotes me again, saying, this something had to be a personality, not a human necessarily, but some kind of thinking, feeling, sentient being. Then Thomas says, this is a big claim. And again, I must ask, what evidence do you have to support this? Well, Thomas, it's the evidence that the personality exists, and we cannot get the personal from the impersonal. He quotes me again. He quotes me saying, why do I say that? Because otherwise there is no explanation for the origin of personality. Thomas says, is there not? What about psychoanalytical theories, social cognitive theories, or biopsychological theories, to name but a few? Well, Thomas, none of them explain the existence of sentience. They only seek to show a process of gradual development. They still fail to explain how consciousness developed. That's the million-dollar mystery here. Thomas quotes me again saying, this is the fundamental hurdle in the field of artificial intelligence. And Thomas says, I don't think so. It's the current inability to create an artificial intelligence with a brain anywhere near the complexity of the human brain. That's the problem. Silicon is no matter, is no match. He says, silicon is no match for gray matter. I want to make sure I'm quoting him accurately. Well, but Thomas, we still haven't figured out what makes the gray matter think. And let's go back to the computer. The very fact that what we have in a computer, complex as it is so much less complex than a human brain, is significant. I find it interesting that when people are attempting to discredit a creator, they point to the fact that people also create. Since we do not create by randomness and chance, it seems that the idea of humans coming into existence in the first place by randomness and chance takes more faith than religious people are accused of having. He quotes me again. Can a computer ever become self-aware? Is it possible to recreate the brain with its ability to think? Can sentience be proven in the laboratory? Only time will answer these questions, but meanwhile they beg the much bigger question. Thomas says, true, but we may never achieve these things. The ability to create an artificial intelligent brain may be always out of our grasp. This does not mean that we need to resort to any special pleading regarding the thinking process of our human brains and how it came to be. Well, I understand what you're saying, Thomas, but it's not special pleading. It is a process of elimination. If personality must come from personality, then there has to be an eternal personality. He quotes me again, since stars and rocks and dust cannot think, and since chemicals outside the chemicals of the brain cannot think, where did personality come from? He says, chemicals inside the brain do not think either. It's the interaction of the chemicals, neurons, etc., which result in the thinking. Well, yes, Thomas, of course, but that only makes my point. By what amazing coincidence does this process result in self-awareness? Chemicals and neurons separated do not think. You just said so yourself. You see, Thomas, one might be able to explain exactly how a computer works, but that explanation does not result in an assumption that the computer came into existence by itself. And Thomas says, a quick analogy, all the parts of a 747 can't fly, but when you put them together and satisfy the correct conditions, the 747 will fly. Exactly, Thomas, and somebody put it together. A couple more minutes of Thomas, and we'll move on to some other questions when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
How many times have you heard the phrase, they're all the same, applied to local contractors? It is unfortunate that a few can tarnish the reputations of many, but it sure is nice when you find a contractor with godly principles. But what if they only do floors or only the painting? What if you want to build a whole new home? Or you want someone to fully complete your remodel or tenant improvements? You need ProBuilt. Serving San Diego since 1987, residential and commercial, quality work completed on time. Local Christian businessman and president of ProBuilt, Vanderbilt, Jim Bell, said, "When people pay you to do a job, they simply want you to do the job. They expect quality work, and they expect it to be done on time. We do that at ProBuilt." For references and dozens of pictures of both residential and commercial work, visit our website, ProBuiltInc.com. That's ProBuiltInc.com. Or call our El Cajon office at 619-593-2965. We're fully bonded and insured. California State License Number 567925. ProBuilt.
I'd like to remind all of my listeners that The Bob Siegel Show has a sister program on our sister station, KPRZ 1210 on the dial. Every Sunday morning from 9 o'clock to 9:30, you can hear City Voice. On this provocative program, my good friend George Runyon interviews a different local Christian ministry every week. You can listen to the show while driving to church, and don't be surprised, you may find it so interesting that you'll stay in the parking lot continuing to listen and skipping those Sunday school donuts. That's City Voice with George Runyon, every Sunday morning from 9 o'clock to 9:30 on our sister station, KPRZ 1210, but right now you're listening to KCBQ 1170. Welcome back. This is News Talk 1170 KCBQ. I'm your host, Bob Siegel, reading a very long email comment about a short article I wrote where I argue that if something had to always exist, you can't get something out of nothing, and if the personal can only come from the personal, then the something that always existed must be some kind of eternal personality. And I consider this a mathematical proof for some kind of God. And Thomas, of course, is not agreeing with me. So he quotes me again in my article. He quotes me saying, "Where did personality come from?" He says, "It's a misleading question, and it implies it has an external origin outside the brain." Well, if the brain isn't the origin of life, Thomas, then there is an external origin, first of all. But it's a valid question, and a question that I have never heard a satisfactory answer to unless personality came from some type of personality. That's the only answer that makes any logical sense. Thomas says, to paraphrase, personality can be defined as a dynamic and organized set of characteristics possessed by a person that uniquely influences his or her cognitions, motivations, and behaviors in various situations. The personality is a combination of mental, social, and biological factors all interacting to produce the outward appearance. You know, that sounds really good, and that sounds really intelligent, and he is an intelligent guy, and I mean that sincerely, but I hope you noticed with all that explanation, he really didn't explain anything. Thomas, you did not explain how this remarkable process came into existence by randomness. You're describing a process that seems to work according to a certain order. Neither did you explain how the existence of sentience came. Well, of course, society influences our personality. We're talking about the time we went from A to B, when there was the impersonal, when something inanimate became personality. He quotes me again. Do we get the personal from the personal? Do we get the personal from the impersonal? He says, what? There has been no evidence other than pure speculation that we get the personal from the personal. And why do we need to invoke such extraordinary claim in order to account for personality anyway? Seems excessive. Thomas, you think that's pure speculation? The only personalities you and I know of by experience of measurable history came from personalities. That is not evidence. Thomas quotes me again. He quotes me saying, now we can add it up like an equation. 0 + 0 = 0. He says, why is there a need to do this? Well, there's a need to do it, Thomas, because it illustrates that only nothing comes from nothing. Then he quotes me again. When I say the alternative equation goes like so. If something had to always exist, I know that by going through my article, we're repeating it a lot, but I think it's good because I think sometimes the argument can be so simple that people don't catch it. Anyway, quotes me saying the alternative equation goes like so. If something had to always exist, he says, not proven. If you can't get something out of nothing, he says, uncertain. And if the personal must come from the personal, he chimes in again, says, not proven. Quotes me again, then this something which always existed is some kind of eternal personality. We have offered a proof for the existence of God. Again, Thomas, whether or not it is proven depends on the definition of proof that we're agreeing on. I acknowledged at the beginning of the article that I was referring to the mathematical proof here and not the definition in my book. Mathematically, I disagree with your assertion that this is not proof. It's absolutely proof. I hear you saying that you don't see it as proof, and I know you say that sincerely, but honestly, Thomas, you have not demonstrated to me that this is not proof. Thomas says, regarding whether I've proven God or not, no, you have not. Even if I was to accept the three premises as true, which I don't, they still do not imply your conclusion. The only way to achieve this is to redefine the concept of God, which you have partially done, to such a state that it does not adhere to any established definition of God in any religion. I can do this also. Can you believe this is the third time he's on this now? But it's okay. You know, religion is such an unusual and emotional subject that I think sometimes people, they argue against things we're not even arguing. So, Thomas, we do not have to define anything in this one argument. We're only, once again, talking about personality coming from eternal personality. As I said before, we must examine the claims of the Bible and integrate the disciplines of history and archaeology in order to venture further in a definition of who God is. Right now, we're not talking about who God is. We're just saying some kind of eternal personality. Well, now he wants to give me an example of how absurd he thinks this is. He thinks I'm just jumping to all kinds of fantastic conclusions. So he says, number one, God is love. Number two, I love. Number three, therefore God exists. He's asserting that my argument is absurd as this one that he put out. But Thomas, this definition that you just put out is based all on assumption. The God of the Bible comes to us from sources that go beyond our mere opinion and beyond the scope of my article about mathematical proof. Anyway, Thomas, I enjoyed this discussion, and I hope we can meet someday to talk in person. You seem like a nice guy. Feel free to call my radio show and talk with me over the air, even though I know it takes some extra effort to do that in an overseas call. But Thomas, I do appreciate your willingness to listen to another side and have an intelligent discussion void of name-calling, as so many do. Take care, my friend. Now, this next one is from Alex in the United Kingdom. Before Christmas, I read a whole litany of questions from Alex, and he listened to them over the air from the United Kingdom. I'm again excited that we're hearing from people in the United Kingdom and Ireland, because I love those countries, want to go to them someday. So I'm excited, because I'm thinking, if I can make a few friends, maybe when I go overseas, I'll have a place to stay. Okay, we'll worry about that another day. Anyway, what Alex is doing now is he's responding to some of the answers that I gave over the air. And one of the questions he asked was about the age of the world. That if the world was created in 6 days, and then we add the genealogies up with Abraham, we get to only several thousand years. He says, and of course, what I had told him, that Genesis 1 was written as a poem, and I don't believe Genesis is telling us how long it took God to create the world. I know that's very controversial and could get me into trouble with fellow Christians, of all people, but I do not interpret a poem the way I interpret other parts of the Bible. Now, Genesis 2 is not poetry. It's historical narrative. So I do believe there was a garden. I do believe there was an Adam and Eve. I believe we fell into sin. I believe there's a Satan. Could God have created the world in 6 days? He certainly could have. He could have done it in 6 days. He could have done it in 6 seconds. But once again, the Bible portrays God as being out of time. When we ask how long it took God to make the world, when God is not limited by time and space, to me, the only honest answer is it took him no amount of time at all. He may have done something which, from our point of view, was a long process. From his point of view, there was no process at all, because he's outside of time. Anyway, that's just to review a little bit about where Alex and I were back in Christmas. We'll look at Alex's responses to some of the things I said. He gives some counter arguments and new questions. We'll look at those when we return. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. Thank you. This is Bob Siegel inviting you to tune in for the Rick Amato Show four nights a week here on 1170 KCBQ. Rick stays on top of the issues local and national. He also does some of the most stimulating interviews you've ever heard. That's the Rick Amato Show, Monday through Thursdays from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. here on Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. You can also find Rick on AmatoTalk.com. This is Bob Siegel on Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. Got another litany of questions, good questions, from our friend Alex. Alex is not actually an atheist himself, but has some doubts about the Bible and that are compounded by the fact that evidently a lot of atheist friends of his are writing him questions. Before Christmas, one of the questions that Alex asked me was about the age of the earth. And does it contradict, according to the Bible, the age of the earth, paleontology, and things like that? Well, I said that I didn't feel the Bible was written in such a way that it was telling us how old the earth is. He says, thanks for the answers, Bob. But I must point out that if you add up the time between Adam and Eve and Jesus, it is 4,000 years. What do you think of this? Well, that measures Adam. When they count up the years of Adam and how long he lived, and they come up to 900 some years, that measures Adam as a mortal man. How long did he live in the Garden of Eden as an immortal man before he became mortal? When he's living in eternity, there's no need to count. The Bible does not tell us how long he was in the garden. Sure, we read it in 2 minutes. That doesn't mean he was only there for 2 minutes. And how old was the world before Adam was even created? We do not know from one poem. That's what Genesis 1 is, a poem. Alex goes on to say, hey, I recently listened to your radio show where you answered my questions, and I just want to reply to them. I wasn't trying to look smart when asking that first question. I know that the question about can God make a rock so heavy he can't lift it is a very old question. In fact, if I searched it on Google, it would come up thousands of times. I was just looking for your opinion on that. You are saying that your God has to follow the rules of logic and not create the rules. If he had to follow the rules of logic, he would not be able to perform all sorts of miracles that he does. Okay, I see what you're saying, Alex. Actually, God himself created the rules. There's no rules above God. Or another way to put it is God just is the way he is. God just is logical. So he creates rules for us, for himself. He just is logical already. And once again, Alex, when the Bible says God can do anything, it means God can do anything that's possible to do. Now, when I talked about your question last time, I quoted C.S. Lewis, who once got a similar question to this. And C.S. Lewis said, nonsense is nonsense, even when we are talking about God. Now, I did not intend to accuse you of trying to be a smart Alec, Alex. Neither am I trying to do a play on the name Alec and Alex right now. And Alex, I apologize if my words came across that way. But if you listen to the show, then you must have heard me very carefully explain that only some atheists ask that question with cleverness and others are sincere. And the show is still posted. You could listen to it again. I also said that I knew you yourself were sincere, that you yourself were not an atheist. I said that again today, and that you were merely passing along questions that have come to you. Now, did you hear all that, Alex? Maybe not. Sometimes we miss things when we listen. I understand. I miss things all the time when people talk to me, but please know that I did go out of my way to make that qualification extremely clear. And Alex, it is precisely because God follows logic that he cannot participate in a logical absurdity. Miracles are not a logical absurdity. Miracles are simply a name given to things with scientific explanations, but explanations human beings do not yet have. And I'm not saying you're absurd for posing the question. I'm saying that technically, that question over the many years it has been around was posited by people for the very purpose of showing the absurdity of a God who can do anything. When the Bible says God can do anything, it means, as C.S. Lewis put it, he can do anything intrinsically possible. God can't be completely good and completely evil at the same time. No, he can't make a rock that even he can't pick up, because we're not even talking about a miracle. We're just talking about nonsense there. Anyway, hope that's a little more clear. Then another question. Alex had asked me why God sometimes destroyed people, for example, in the flood and in wars. And I said, well, when he destroys people, it's because of sin. So he really takes issue with this. He says he only did it for people's sin. When he flooded the world and killed many people, including pregnant females with unborn children, what sin could an unborn child commit? An unborn child is unable to commit a sin. He does not understand what a sin is. Well, first of all, Alex, I'm glad we're in full agreement that an unborn child is a child. It's a very strong belief of mine and yours too, evidently. But to getting back to your question, actually, we're not taught that God flooded the world to hurt babies. We're taught that he flooded the world not to kill innocent people either, but to destroy a very wicked people, specifically named in the Bible, and they're called the Nephilim. Now, this was after Satan, a spiritual being, turned against God and also influenced and turned one-third of the angels away from God. These angels disobeyed God, took on human form, and had sexual relationships with mortal women in disobedience. Their offspring were a half-breed between angels and humans called once again the Nephilim. The purpose of the flood was to destroy the Nephilim. The disembodied spirits of the Nephilim are what we today call demons. Now, I know a lot of you are thinking, boy, sometimes Siegel sounds logical, but he's lost it. Now, this what spiritual beings taking on human bodies, having sex with women, this sounds like Greek mythology. It does sound like Greek mythology. But let me tell you something. The Bible predates Greek mythology. If all cultures go back to the Garden of Eden, go back to Adam and Eve, if all cultures have the same roots, doesn't it make sense that this one true story will then get distorted and have different versions of the story in different cultures? As for demons, again, I know a lot of you don't believe in demons, but I challenge anyone. I'll just challenge you right now. If you do not believe in them, you should read a book called People of the Lie by M. Scott Peck. Now, M. Scott Peck is a psychiatrist and was an atheist before he wrote that book. He was an atheist and a psychiatrist who turned to Christianity as a result of meeting demon-possessed people who came to him for counsel. Anyone who's been delivered by a demon knows they exist. I myself have cast out demons. I don't expect you to believe me. I don't expect you to believe me at all. I don't blame you, but I'm telling you the truth for what it's worth. They exist. Now back to the flood. Did innocent babies also die in the flood? We're not giving a lot of detail. Perhaps they did. Perhaps it was more than just the Nephilim. But if they did, then they went immediately to be with God in heaven, and they're living with him for all of eternity. By the way, babies didn't just die in the flood. Babies die all the time. Humans die all the time. It happens every day. It's sad. It's tragic, but it does happen every day. This is certainly not some unique problem with the flood or with the Bible. Are we going to automatically assume that no God could possibly exist simply because people die? That would be quite a stretch. However, having said that, the Bible does say we were not meant to die, that a loving God does not want us to die. He created us to live forever. But as a species, we told God to eat hay and we turned to sin. Now, no, babies did not make that choice. Adults did. So God, by his grace, takes babies into heaven. Now, let me say this as carefully as I can. If the part about heaven sounds far-fetched or sounds like a cop-out, I do understand. It once sounded that way to me too, until I came to discover by fact and by experience that the God of the Bible is true and his words are true, including his words about heaven. If we really believe in heaven, the idea of babies going to heaven or anyone going to heaven is a great comfort. If we do not believe the Bible when it talks about heaven, then why believe the Bible when it says people were wiped out by a flood? Now, there's a very important subtlety to catch here, because there are two kinds of questions people ask about the Bible: academic questions and moral questions. Academic questions ask for evidence that the Bible is true. Moral questions are quite different. Moral questions assume, for the sake of the conversation, that the Bible is true, but question whether the God of the Bible is behaving in a proper way. And then they say, well, if he doesn't seem to be behaving in a proper way, then maybe that'll be a reason to not believe in the Bible. But people don't always catch it to even ask that question when they go, well, why did God do this? Why did God do that? You know, they may not even believe in God, but they're saying, why did God do this? Why did God do that? They have to, for that moment, suspend belief and assume, just for the sake of the argument, for the sake of the conversation, that the God is true. In other words, these questions only remain fair within the boundaries of their assumptions. Now follow this question. Assuming that the Bible is the word of God, assuming that, isn't it unfair that God allowed innocent babies to die in a flood? Answer, assuming that the Bible is the word of God, those children are in heaven and they are very happy. They are not screaming at God for bringing them there. If we don't believe the Bible when it says children are going to heaven, why do we believe the Bible when it says that God wiped people out with a flood? You can't have it both ways. Now Alex continues. He says, if a person doesn't suspect that Jesus is real and doesn't believe he is the Son of God and lives a good moral life, and never witnesses the Holy Spirit, then he can go to heaven? That's what you made clear. Well, no, I didn't actually say that. That's what you're saying. First of all, the Bible teaches that nobody lives a good life. We are also guilty of sin, all of us. Second, the Holy Spirit probes the conscience of all people. This gives them a little bit of light. If they respond to their conscience and ask God, whoever God is, to forgive their sin, then perhaps sincere ignorance of Jesus will be overlooked. It would still mean Jesus died for their sins. It would still mean they were saved through Jesus. It would still mean Jesus is the only way. I'll get back to more of Alex's questions and more of your questions next week. You are always welcome. Your questions are welcome too.
Thank you for listening to The Bob Siegel Show. The views and opinions are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. The Bob Siegel Show was brought to you in part by the Law Office of Thomas Pinkerton, helping infertile families have children. Tom Pinkerton would like to invite you to help Bob expand his radio program by donations or sponsorship. For more information about Bob's ministry, go to www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you can read Bob's articles and get information about Bob's books. That's Bob Siegel, SIEGEL.net.